Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 16th, 2001. In the fireside this morning is Michael Paulette. Today's session number is POM 2001-03, and it's titled Last Call Return, Hear Who Called You Last. Let's listen in.
In media ministry, let us begin to commence to start to roll the tape. Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
By way of very short introduction, my name is Michael Paulette, and I am a pastor at King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And I also teach in the Religious Studies Department at the University of Saskatchewan and in the Philosophy Department there as well. So I wear many different hats, or I guess this week I have many different callings. And so the Bible study this week is, and next week as well, we'll be looking at the farewell discourse in John. That would be John chapters 13 through 17. It's Jesus' last words to his disciples, if you will. And it's a call into community. A little bit of an overview here in terms of why I've chosen this section from John's Gospel as our focus for study this week, how I see it fitting in with the theme. I have called you by name, you are mine, is in Isaiah chapter 43. And obviously the word calling is important there. But the other thing that I found fascinating about that little phrase is that the you in the Hebrew, I have called you by name, is plural, not singular. So it's you plural. So it's the sense of you in there, if you will, of corporate Israel, of the community and the people of God. And so I wanted to look at that sense of calling, calling us, right? Not just the individual, but us as community. And how does Jesus call us as communities of faith, call us into being a community of faith? And so it's from that sense of that plural notion, that understanding of community, that I want to look at call. Secondly, to talk about call, of course, call is an important word in many places in the Bible. There are the calls of Moses, there are the calls of the prophet, and all of that. But I thought at first maybe to look at calling, I would go to a secular expert about calling. And so in Saskatchewan, the major phone company there is called SaskTel. And so kind of on a crazy notion, I guess, I went down to one of their outlets one day downtown and said, you know, I'm a pastor in Unibrow, you know, and I get so many calls and all of this. Can you help me handle my calls? And of course, the person there, the woman there, was very helpful. Said, oh, yes, we have all these different features for calling and that you can put on your phone. And so I went down there and she gave me all these little cards, right, that explain all the features. And there were over 30 of them, none of which I ever got because I could care less. But it's interesting in terms of all these features that you can put on your phone that have to do with calling. I mean, and it's kind of reassuring to know that your phone company is a kind of call expert. So they're there. And some of them are very theological. And so kind of as a subtitle for this notion of calling, for each section, we're going to look at the kind of phone company point of view on all of this. And so today in John's Gospel, as we look at Jesus calling us into community, we're going to look at the foot washing. or as the phone company would put it, I think, we are going to look at call display. It lets you see who is calling. And so I want you to think about the foot washing today as call display. It lets us see who is calling, how Jesus is calling us. So that's where we can thank the phone company for giving us some insight. A little bit more about the overview of John's Gospel and why I wanted to look at John's Gospel and the farewell discourse in doing this is that John's Gospel is very concerned about community and talks about community, but John's Gospel really has no ecclesiology, right? The fancy word for some kind of doctrine or teaching about the church. For example, you can go to Paul's letters, Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, Corinthians chapter 12, and there Paul does have an ecclesiology, a teaching about the church, and that wonderful, rich metaphor and image about how we are the body of Christ. And you can go to other places within the New Testament and find those images about church in terms of people of God, the household of God, family of God, the building with the foundation, you know, Christ the cornerstone, the foundation of the apostles and prophets, and all of those kinds of things. You won't find those images in John's Gospel. He has Jesus call us into community, but he doesn't give us a big teaching about what it is to be church. We have to work a little harder in John's Gospel to get that. The other thing in John's Gospel is that what it is to be the community of faith or church is characterized in three basic ways. To talk about church in John is to talk about disciples, to talk about friends, and to talk about children of God. And sometimes in front of children, there's the adjective little children. And little children can cut both ways. It can be a term of endearment, or it can be a term of rebuke, right? Like, stop acting like little children. So it goes both ways. Of those terms that John uses, what's also interesting in terms of talking about the community is John does not talk about the community of faith as a special or unique group. For example, the word apostles never appears in John's Gospel. So that Peter, John, James, Philip are never called the apostles. In John's Gospel, he doesn't use that term. Doesn't like it. In fact, he only uses the term the 12 four times. So again, he doesn't even like to talk about those 12 particular people. It's not his thing. He uses the term disciples 78 times. So you kind of get a sense there. This is a term John likes. And John uses that term in talking about who we usually think about as disciples, the 12, those 12 guys. But for John, he would say, don't ever, ever think about disciples in terms of only those 12. In fact, in John's Gospel, disciples are a very disparate group. You're going to find all sorts of interesting characters in John's Gospel that are considered disciples. And so now, since it's after 9 o'clock and you've all had your first coffee, it's time for your first quiz. And that is, from your knowledge and reading of John's gospel, who would be considered disciples?
All of us.
Yes, but I want us to talk first about characters in John's gospel. Who in John's gospel would be considered a disciple? I'll give the first answer, since it's the easy answer. Peter is a disciple in John's gospel. But, interestingly, in John's gospel, Peter does not have the same role of prominence that Peter has in the synoptics, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. There, you know, Peter is always kind of the leader and the one around whom others might be organized. That's not the case in John's gospel. Peter is not the star disciple in John's gospel. Who is the epitome of disciple in John's gospel?
Probably John.
No. Anybody?
The beloved disciple.
And this is what I love about John, right? Given our theme, I have called you by name, you are mine. What's the beloved disciple's name?
John.
No name. This is generic beloved disciple. The beloved disciple has no name. So that means, who could be the beloved disciple?
Anybody.
The beloved disciple could be sitting in this room, and we don't know it. Right? That's, again, that calling us into community, that sense of plurality there, right? I have called all of you by name. And maybe what is the name we have been called? We have been called beloved disciple. So that even our name of Paul or John or Jeannie or Sonia or whatever is not as important as being called beloved. Think about that for community. Other disciples in John's gospel.
The women that gathered around.
Yeah, who?
Well, Mary Magdalene and all the others.
Okay, of course.
Mary
There's Mary Magdalene, and Mary Magdalene is very important in John's gospel. Why? What's Mary's role in John's gospel? Who goes to the empty tomb in John's gospel? Not all the women. Mary. The only one. The only disciple who goes to the tomb and sees that it's empty. And she goes back to tell who? Well, primarily, these two guys. Peter and the beloved. The two key disciples that seem to have leadership roles in this Christian community, in this community of disciples, are told by Mary what's the score. And of course, they go back and look at the tomb and everything, and they go back home. Mary is around, and to whom does Jesus first appear?
Mary.
Right? So that in that sense, if you're going to go by, at least as the other Gospels would have it, right, that Jesus appears to, of course, the important people after, you know, the women see the empty tomb and they go back, but then when there's the resurrection appearances, this is going to happen to important people. And we know if you're going to appear to important people, obviously you must appear to men. Except in John's gospel, you appear to a woman. Absolutely unheard of. I mean, women have no credibility. Women have no status. Women have no authority. Women can't be trusted to be responsible. Why would Jesus appear to a woman? A whole new sense of what it is to be disciple, of what it is to be community. Very disparate group. The other women in John's gospel that are important are Mary and Martha, and as well, brother Lazarus. And then there is also the woman at the well. John chapter 4, the Samaritan woman at the well. And again, the contrast there. The woman is at the well, Jesus is speaking to her, she goes back to the village and tells the others there, I have met a prophet, I have seen the Messiah, all of that. On that point, if you will, while she is being a disciple and an evangelist, what are all the other disciples doing? They're having a disciples caucus saying, what's Jesus doing trying this to the man? One errand that shouldn't be going on, and gee, what are we going to do about it? And there he goes, right? So they're having their own little rump group mumbling and complaining about what Jesus is doing while this woman is being a disciple. Okay? Other of the traditional disciples, again, the ones we don't hear a lot about in other gospels, seem to get a little more attention in John's gospel. We'll talk about Nathanael and Philip,
Thomas,
and Andrew and Thomas. All right. Now we don't hear much about these folks in the other gospels. In the other gospels, it's Peter, and the other two biggies are James and John. Well, James and John are mentioned here, but they're small potatoes. Their important role is they own boats so that they can go out fishing and not catch anything. That's about the role James and John play here. That's it. So that again, John's gospel, talking about church, community, disciples, wants to really get our thinking kind of topsy-turvy and thinking about discipleship and what it means to be discipleship and a community of disciples in different ways. Let me read for you a quotation from a well-known biblical scholar, Ernst Caseman. He spent his whole career basically studying John's gospel and Paul's letter to the Romans. And in one of his books on John's gospel, The Testament of Jesus, this is what he says about disciples. He says, quote, if all are disciples and friends of Jesus, then differentiations among them can no longer be decisive. The relationship to the Lord determines the whole picture of the Johannine church to such an extent that the differences between individuals recede. Unquote. John's picture of church, John's picture of discipleship is based upon one criterion, your relationship to the Lord. All the other things that might differentiate you, gender, ethnicity, culture, social status, class, recede into the background and disappear. John's sense of community is a very inclusive sense of community, right? I mean, and again, even that community is disparate. I mean, think about where we're all over the place, from these Galilean disciples to this Samaritan woman to Mary Magdalene, who supposedly is from Magdala, and all of these folks, Mary, Martha, Lazarus, they don't seem to follow Jesus around. They stay put in their house at Bethany, but Jesus comes to them and stays with them and visits them. And all of these folks, these disparate folks, are disciples. They're part of the community. And I think this is part of the wonderful picture that John tries to paint about community. The other thing that's interesting about this, I think, is in terms of what's going on at the same time. At the time that John's gospel is written, and let's not get too excited about dates, let's just say basically it's at the turn of the first century, so we'll just say 100. John's gospel is written in 100, and his talk about the church. The other things that are being written at about that same time are the pastoral epistles. That's 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus, and those are the pastorals in that. What a different view of church we have. These folks that are being written again, scholars call these epistles move the understanding of church into what's called early Catholicism, or it's when the church gets structured and institutionalized. If you read 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, now we start having bishops and presbyters and deacons, and everybody has a specific role and everybody has a place. And this is where we have hierarchy and structure coming in. This is, right, this is the cutting edge of church practice now, right? If you really want to be with it as a church, you got to have bishops, and you got to have elders, and you got to have deacons, and you have to, and you know, widows have to have their place. And everybody has their place within this structure and hierarchy. And at the same time that all this, you know, new church structure and organization is going on, John's gospel is coming out at the same time and says to all that. And by the way, it's a very technical theological term. So I, you know, be very careful when you use that, because it has lots of theological implications. Right? John says to all of that. Right? There is no sense of that kind. You know, there's no bishops and elders and deacons and all of that in John's gospel. It's again that disciple community where all are very equal, inclusively related to one another because of their relationship to Christ. Now, of course, when John's gospel comes up over against this, there's already controversy among these various communities and all of that. And most of these folks who, again, my comment, unfortunately, win out, basically find the Johannine community to be kind of the weirdo, marginal, heretical community, right? So we got to kind of handle those folks. And one of the things, in my own language, they criticize John's gospel of being is obsolete, because after all that kind of equality, community, we're all one big group or one small group stuff doesn't work anymore. That's obsolete, that's nostalgic, that's a romantic wishing of how things can be. That if you want to get with it, and if you want to get into the real world, you got to start thinking about bishops and elders and deacons and all that kind of stuff. and not this romantic, nostalgic, oh, how we're all just together, right? You're getting there, right? Isn't that the kind of thing, like up here, this little romantic, nostalgic community, which just doesn't get it when it comes to the real world? Yesterday, I overheard a comment from a woman who was saying, well, you know, up here, all this stuff, you know, about chopping up your banana peels and all of that and sorting out all your garbage. Well, you know, you can do that up here when you've got nothing else to do and all these volunteers who do that stuff. But down there in the real world, I'm lucky if I have even enough time to throw away my trash. Okay, well, the question though is, what is the real world? John's sense of this, right, would be to say, you know, I'm not romanticizing this community that Jesus set up, and we'll see as we get into John 13 why that's the case. But his claim and what he's saying about disciples is that is the real world. Or in John's language, he's saying that is the truth. And all of that stuff down lake or out there or what you think about is real world, that's virtual reality. That's the world of deception and lies and malice and death and all those other things. And it's only real because you yourselves have been deluded by it. Right, the counter to John's understanding of community is he uses the vocabulary of the world. And what John usually means by the world when he contrasts it to the community of faith is that the world is the realm of deficiency and defect, sickness and death, misunderstanding, doubts and lies. And again, for John, the choice is, and in which world do you want to live? Don't think about what Holden is trying to do in being community as nostalgia and romantic and fantasy. This is the very real blood and guts way of at least some disciples trying to be a community of faith. And it has its strengths and weaknesses, to be sure. We're not trying to set Holden on a pedestal. But the other thing is, don't turn it into fantasy and try to contrast Holden to real world out there, right? John's way of thinking is, no, this is real. And this is what we are called as disciples to be, that community of faith. And that again, right, that may take on a Holden kind of flavor, it may not. The issue there again is living faithfully in the world. And we'll see some of the dimensions that are there for that. So that again becomes kind of the conflict that we have in John's gospel. The kind of conflict that I think that would come in is to say within our own world, you know, again, kind of cutting edge ecclesiology is the whole mega church movement, right? What does John's gospel have to say about mega church movement? Whether that be the kind of Willow Creek, Bill Hybels stuff out of Chicago, whether it's the Community of Joy, Walt Kallestad stuff out of Phoenix, whether it's Crystal Cathedral, Robert Schuller stuff, or whether it's even kind of the secularized spirituality, get on with life kind of stuff that you get either from Dr. Laura, who in 30 seconds can give you all the answers to your life, or from Oprah, who, you know, if Oprah has some way of being whole and that, you know, obviously it will be a bestseller. And to all of those ways of doing things, right, of being community or church or even disciples and living together, I think John would always say no to all of them and get us to think through being a community of faith in a very different manner. So that's the kind of challenge that I see here in John's gospel. Okay, that's kind of the overview to fog it all up for you. And then we'll see if we can clarify. Are you following so far? Kind of still awake? Good. Then let's turn to the beginning of the discourse there, the farewell discourse, and look at the foot washing today. John chapter 13, verses 1 to 17, is what I'd like to look at. And again, a couple opening comments here to set the scene before we get into the very specific foot washing itself. And that is, again, that John's gospel, John is very serious about things, but he always does it in an ironic and humorous way. And so if you are going to be a serious student of John's gospel, you must laugh, all right? Because that's the only way you can be serious about John, laughing to see what's going on. And again, usually it is laughing at ourselves, at the way in which we think we are a community of faith and fall so laughably short of it. I mean, it's a great sense of irony and humor. Part of that irony already comes out that the whole farewell discourse, or it happens at the time of the Last Supper. And the foot washing, of course, happens during the Lord's Supper. But the irony of all of this is John doesn't say a word about the Lord's Supper. You know, no words of institution, no talking about the meal itself and what the meal means and all of that. The whole content of the Lord's Supper itself is omitted. As though, not to say it's unimportant, but John is already wanting to get us to focus somewhere else. The second thing that's kind of ironic and surprising and will get us to thinking is that the foot washing doesn't happen where it should. Within Middle Eastern etiquette of the time and everything, foot washing is a feature of hospitality. I mean, you're going to invite someone over to your home for dinner. You're going to have a meal. The mode of transportation, of course, is walking. And that's either barefoot or sandals. So, you know, you're walking to your friend's house or whatnot. You arrive, and the appropriate thing for hospitality would be, at that time, a servant would wash feet. Or if you're a close friend, someone, you know, that the host or hostess themselves may wash the feet of their guests. But it happens at the very beginning. But not here. During supper, right, between the soup and salad course, Jesus decides to get up and wash feet. Or, to put it in the context of the Eucharist, it would be as if last night, during the distribution, about a third of the way through, Ben, the village pastor, would turn on his microphone and say, "I know I said head for the bread, but I have a basin over here, and I'd like you to start coming over here. We're going to have a foot washing now, so come over here." And all of a sudden, he starts tapping people on the shoulder and, right, diverting them from the bread and the cup over and starts washing their feet. Well, what's going on here, right? This is rather disruptive, to say the least. But this is what's happening, right? During the meal, and again, to think about it in the context, during the Lord's Supper, no less, all of a sudden, Jesus starts washing feet. And of course, the other thing that's shocking and surprising is that it is Jesus who is washing feet. Not a servant, not the lowliest disciple, but Jesus himself is washing feet. Along with that, the setting that is there. Verses 1 through 3 of chapter 13. Let me read that simply from a New Revised Version. It says, "Now before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The devil had already put it into the heart of Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray him. And during supper, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he had come from God and was going to God," and then we get into the action, got up from the table, etc. The thing there about that introduction, kind of just structurally, we have that phrase in verse 1, Jesus knew that his hour had come. Verse 3, Jesus knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. Knowing there. In between that knowing, in the middle, what's happening? Satan, the diabolical one, the devil, had put it into Judas' heart to betray him. Even in the midst of the Lord's Supper and the foot washing, there is evil. And one of the things that John is going to be dealing with throughout these sections, and we'll look at it more closely tomorrow as we're going to talk about Judas as a disciple in the community and what that means. John always helps us understand that evil is right there in the community, in the midst of the community. You don't have to go up there or down there or out there or someplace else to look for or find evil. It is within. It is here in the community. But the other thing, I mean, I think just structurally that the picture that John paints here is wonderful. But even though that evil is within the community, what? Jesus surrounds or encircles or embraces that evil. Jesus knows it is there and responds accordingly. Responds in ways that enable us to handle evil. And it's in our midst. So that already a word of comfort for us as a disciple community is that although there is evil within our community, and again, right, that's why John is not romantic and nostalgic and giving us fantasy, there's evil there, just like there is in any community, right? Holden, your congregations, whatever. There is that evil in our midst too. But what? It is still always surrounded, embraced by Jesus. Think about the prologue The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness does not overcome it. The picture here is if evil would overcome Jesus, if darkness would overcome light, then it would have been structured. We would have talked about the devil and Judas in verse 1, and then Jesus in the middle, and the devil and Judas in verse 3, and we would say, see, look at, we're encircled and surrounded and besieged by evil. No. It's the other way around. Evil is there, but it does not overcome Jesus. It does not overcome the light. So kind of keep that one in the back of your mind as we think about the foot washing, but also as we go into some of these things tomorrow. Verse 4, we get into the foot washing proper. This is now the real call display. And for John, what is important here are the verbs, because for him, all of the verbs in verses 4 and 5 are loaded with levels of meaning. There can be the literal level of just the action of what's happening, but there are all sorts of different levels of understanding that go on there. And so then in verse 4, it's that Jesus got up from the table, or again, the word that's used there, I would translate that, Jesus arose from the table, because the word John uses is the same word he uses for resurrection. So if you want to be really literalistic about this, you would say, Jesus resurrected from the table. And then what? And laid down his outer garments. And this phrase of laid down is used by John in chapter 10 about the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. So that we have this image here now of, if you will, the risen Jesus laying down his life, laying down his garments. Again, for John, an indication that what Jesus is doing, if you will, it is the risen Jesus. Jesus does this out of life, not out of death or out of weakness. But this is like the risen one already in our midst is the one who lays down his life for us. And then what does he do? And taking up a towel, or again, and receiving or accepting this towel. And of course, this towel will symbolize the whole action of the foot washing, symbolize what's going here. And what does Jesus do again? He takes that up. He understands this as his mission. This is who he is to be in terms of whom God, as the one whom God has sent. And then he ties this towel around himself. He is totally enwrapped in this mission. Or for those of you who still admire Elizabethan English, he is girded in this mission. He girds himself with this towel. He wraps this towel around him to show what this mission is. And then after that, in verse 5, the New Revised Standard Version says he poured water into a basin. Again, in the Greek, it's much more interesting than that. It would read, then he threw water into a basin, or into a pitcher. Have any of you ever think about, you know, our drinking pitchers, where our water pitchers, have you ever tried to throw water into that? That will be, don't tell anybody in the kitchen I suggested that, but maybe that could be your assignment at lunch. Try to throw water into the water pitcher. And you go, already there, what's John getting at? You know, why would you throw water into a pitcher? And so I said, well, Where else does John use that verb throwing in the gospel? That's very interesting. That verb throwing is used as throwing stones when Jesus is involved in some controversies and folks get a little upset with him. They pick up stones and throw them at him. There are other places in terms of the controversies where Jesus accuses some folks of throwing insults and lies at him. And then in John chapter 9, the healing of the man born blind after he does his testimonies at the synagogue and the people are fed up with him, they throw him out of the synagogue. And so Jesus throws water. Everyone else in the gospel throws stones, throws insults and lies, and throws people. The contrast, I think, there is, if you're going to throw stones and lies and people out of things, it is a way of death. Water, of course, again, in John's gospel, Jesus is the water of life. If you're going to throw water, to throw life at something. And so the contrast here again about the disciple community and what Jesus is calling us to do as disciples, as we will wash one another's feet, is what are you going to do at people? Are you going to throw stones at people, or are you going to throw water at them? In other words, are you going to throw the ways of life or the ways of death? And again, we see Jesus as the one who throws life. And he washes the disciples' feet. He begins to do that. And then along comes Peter. Verse 6. And of course, Peter asks the obvious question. And John puts it there in terms of Peter would say, Lord, you, my feet are going to wash? No, right? I mean, there's the real contrast there, right? On the one hand, Jesus. On the other hand, Peter's feet. And Peter says, these two things, Jesus and my feet, do not belong in the same picture. It doesn't work. And of course, Jesus tells Peter that, you know, you just don't understand, which is Peter's typical problem. And Peter again responds in verse 8, again, you will never wash my feet. The Greek there adds a little phrase, into eternity. So that I would kind of translate that, it's as though Peter is saying to Jesus, so help me, Jesus, it just ain't ever going to happen that you will wash my feet. There is that kind of understanding there. And again, to say, why is that? What's going on here with feet? Part of that is, I think, again, the sense of order that Peter has. Certainly, Jesus as Lord and teacher should not be washing the feet of a disciple. But I think even more than that, this whole understanding of what's going on here is this notion about vulnerability and openness. The part of what's happening here is, and you think about this with your own experiences, right? What would it take from you to have someone else wash your feet? In the first session, we did a little poll on this, and it was unanimous. If you had the choice of being the foot washer or the foot washee, who would you want to be? How many want to be foot washers? Raise your hand. How many would want to be the washee? Really? Wow, that's amazing. Nobody wanted to have their feet washed in the first session.
Talk around here for a day.
Well, that was precisely why, right? Corns, calluses, bunions, smell, blisters, cracked toenails, all of that. And now you're going to open yourselves up to have somebody else see that, be involved with that.
Could I share a story?
Yes.
At our church in Messiah, Pasadena, Pastor Peg is our pastor. And we have another pastor also, Spanish speaking. We have two parts of our congregation. And our council, church council, is Spanish and English. And Monday, Thursday, our two pastors washed our feet in front of the whole congregation, sitting up in the chancel. And it was a powerful, wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. And did everyone come forward for that?
No, the church council.
Oh,
had
I see.
Feet washed.
I see
the.
I see the church council.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
As a sign of being servants to the
right.
community.
Are there from congregate? How many are in a congregation or community that does practice foot washing on Monday, Thursday?
On occasion.
On occasion. Yeah. We do it too, but folks are very hesitant about that. I have one story about that in my own experiences here. A woman who comes forward for the foot washing, and she wears nylon hose, but it's not by act. I mean, it's not like she forgot. Oh, it's Monday, Thursday, and there's a foot wash. No, she usually doesn't wear hose, and she puts them on here intentionally. And leaves them on for the foot washing. And after I asked her about that, and her response was, "Well, I can't go up there and have you wash my naked feet."
Oh.
So they're clear hose. I mean, you can see through the hose or whatever, right? But it's the whole notion that somehow going up there in bare feet would be improper, inappropriate. It's going, you can wash my feet, but I'm not taking, you can wash my feet, but I'm not taking my socks off. Which also made me in terms of a physician recently, I asked him when folks come into the office for physicals and all of that, and they have to disrobe and everything. I asked him, I said, people get undressed and all of that kind of stuff. I said, but when you ask them to do that, do they take off their socks or leave them on? And of course, he thought, gee, are you weird? He goes, why are you asking that question? And I said, well, I'm doing a Bible study on foot washing, and I just like to, people and feet are kind of, and he said, well, come to think of it, he said, I would think over half of the people leave their socks on. They pull off their underwear and everything, of course, but they leave their socks on. And then, you will look at their feet or whatever. But in that, you don't have to raise your hand or anything, but for yourself, when you go in for your checkup or whatever, do you leave your socks on or do you take them off?
Depends if it's cold or not.
All right. The utilitarian answer always comes through. But think about that. I think part of this here, is that sense of vulnerability, openness that's there. The other thing here, the one last point I want to make, and then we'll open it up for more discussion, is that I think the foot washing, and particularly when Jesus then encourages the disciples to wash one another's feet, is not merely an example of humble service. If you think the foot washing is just about humble service, about, you know, pastors washing parishioners' feet, or even vice versa, parishioners washing pastors' feet, and that, I think that's only half the story. I think what is here, and again that sense of the pouring out of the water and the washing of feet, is that Jesus is saying, as disciples for one another, we must help one another to die. We must help one another to die, particularly to our own egos, our own self-justifications and notions of self-worth, and again, thinking of importance. And so there you might say, well, yeah, that's the humble service, but it's more than that. I think about Bonhoeffer's opening sentence in the Cost of Discipleship. When Jesus calls a person, he bids that person come and die. And I think that's what's happening here in the foot washing. Jesus is saying to the disciples, right, is this disciple community, come and die. Come and die. And that to wash one another's feet in that sense is that we are helping, we are preparing one another for our own death. Not just physical death, but that death of being part of the world. Because that is what we must die to. And living and then coming to life again. The Spirit, the risen Christ, who brings us to life and who calls us into life with this new word that forms this new community. Peter is already engaged in denial here in chapter 13, not just in front of the fire. And we see the denial here in terms of Peter denies Jesus his feet. And think about that. How do we, either individually or more importantly, as community, deny Jesus our feet? Right? As volunteers, we might say, you know, Jesus, Lord, take my hands, take my heart, take my head, leave my feet. I'm sorry, you've asked for too much now, Jesus, when you've asked for my feet, when you've asked to wash my feet. I'm sorry, you know, we have to draw a line somewhere. And Jesus says, right, if I don't wash your feet, you have no part of me. You have no heritage with me. You are not in this reign and rule, but in a different world and reign and rule. So maybe to hear your responses, you're thinking through about this whole thing, but the whole notion, again, to stick with feet, although we're not having a foot fetish here, right? How do we deny Jesus our feet? Or how do we give them over to Jesus? And that sense of dying, I think, that comes with that.
I'm hearing, I'm just kind of mulling in my mind some thoughts about that. The thing that occurs to me is that we stress service so much, and certainly having one's feet washed is about receiving service. But I think for many of us, it's hard to receive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because what I've been mulling since last week in the text from last night's Vespers service of the Good Samaritan is we emphasize so much that service side of it. And what suddenly struck me is, you know, if you go back to the original question that the lawyer asked and put yourself in the position of the lawyer and says, who is my neighbor? My neighbor is the one who serves me when I don't even want that person to do that. I mean, it's the Samaritan serving the Jew. And I think, you know, if I were that Jew, when do I put up those walls that the other disciple from washing, each other's, mm-hmm. washing each other's feet? Where do I build those barriers? And that's because, again, the service thing, you know, a lot of people are talking about service and doing a lot with that. And that just becomes another one of those things that I do, you know, not that Jesus does.
Yeah, I mean, I think here again that the service thing is only we push that in this, but I think that kind of misses what Jesus is really pushing here in terms of there are all sorts of other places in the gospel where we talk about service. Here, you know, Jesus is not engaged in healing or feeding or whatever. It's foot washing, and it's not particularly to show service, but it is to show love. But it is that love of giving one's life for the other, and also that sense of being that other, open to that kind of death. Open to saying, all the other standards by which you measure whether you're successful or not, or good or not, they're all out there. You have to die to all of that. Yes, please.
One thing that I was kind of thinking about during the reading is living in Thailand, the foot is considered the dirtiest part of your body. And if you were to show your foot, the bottom of your foot to someone, that is like the biggest insult, like swearing. And it's interesting here that we don't want our feet to be shown because we also have, you know, vulnerability about our feet, like the nakedness of it. And it is considered dirty. I mean, that's why people don't want to see it. Like, even Peter was mentioning, hey, why don't you take my hands and my face? You know, something where, you know, it's just like, you use a little bit more, but that Jesus would go for your feet or, you know, something the lowest part of you. And I think that is the exposure to your vulnerability and your openness. Like, it's not just showing, Jesus doesn't want to see the parts. He wants to see all the parts of you and, you know, where your pain is or where you are dirty or where you're hurting. And I think that's the difficult thing for us.
Is there a comment over here?
Well, I was thinking the similar thing to her, that when we teach about foot washing and incarnation or doing it, I think it's important to focus that it's all about trust and vulnerability, not just that it's, you know, half about servanthood and maybe half about something else, but I think Jesus' emphasis is really on intimacy within the community that he was creating, and that's kind of what way he led his disciples, that he was going to lead them, that he was teaching them how to be community for each other in his absence, that they needed to have that kind of intimacy together because they needed that support. If they were going to be out in the world, they needed that kind of support. I think there's a richness in that, some of what she was saying.
The bell has rung. You've been extremely patient. Thank you. We'll pick it up tomorrow about Judas and also the comment about raising the foot and what that might mean. Thank you.
Thank you.